I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. After the Sandy Hook mass shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, Congressman Tim Murphy investigated the country's mental health system and concluded it was anti-patient, anti-family, and anti-medical care. He introduced the Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act to fix the problems he identified. He calls for increasing the number of psychiatric beds, allowing mental health providers to share patient information with parents and caregivers, and expands on something called assistant outpatient treatment, with judges forcing patients to undergo mental health treatment and more. Congressman Murphy joins us on Radio Times, a Republican representing Pennsylvania's 18th district, serving his seventh term in Congress. He's also a psychologist, and he sits on the House Energy and Commerce Committee and the Health and Environment and Economy Committees. And Tim Murphy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you.
Would your bill have prevented the mass shooting in Sandy Hook?
Well, a number of things you said about my bill, first of all, are not correct. But could it have prevented Sandy Hook? If we got treatment to people early on, if we had real treatment available in communities, if we eliminated the federal barriers to care, if we made sure that the federal dollars going towards research and care was not going for silly, frivolous activities, we could have prevented a lot more than Sandy Hook. When you look at this year, 2015, the bloody summer, really the bloody seasons of this year, and you note how over time, when we close all these institutions, these asylums that needed to be shut down, that had 550,000 psychiatric hospital beds in the 1950s, and now we have less than 40,000 beds. We don't have a place where people were in crisis in mental health. We have a system that has prevented more beds, prevented people who are between ages 22 and 64 to go to a hospital that has more than 16 beds. We have Medicaid rules that say you can't see two doctors in the same day. We have limits on how many days you can spend in a hospital. We do not have enough psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, or clinical peer support specialists. We've cut back on community mental health services. We spend money on absolutely absurd things, and I want to read you some of these things because it's important because it relates to your next guest, too. But SAMHSA, the lead federal agency on this, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, sends hundreds of thousands of dollars over the years to conferences that have things on here like how to make pillowcase art for healing, how to divert people from psychiatric inpatient stays, believing that the hearing voices is part of the human experience and making judgment-free connections on that, working on dancing your way to wellness and recovery, classes on gentle yoga, making room for mystery and mutual support, creating a collage from magazine images and text, using poetry, rap, and music, et cetera, et cetera. Getting involved with unleashing the beast in yourself, the secrets of gardening, sleeping your way to wellness, cooking workshops. This is not treatment. And it's very important we understand. But what has emerged over the years is this concept that some groups have that mental illness is not a real and genuine thing. We've heard from people that say auditory hallucinations are just subjective, and just because you don't hear them doesn't mean it doesn't exist. We need to understand that serious mental illness, such as schizophrenia and bipolar, is a brain illness. It isn't a difference of opinion. It's not an attitude. And when we have end up closing down these institutions, and so people haven't suddenly got better because we no longer perceive them as needing hospitalization. What has happened is we put them in jails. We have seen an increase in homelessness. We've seen an increase in suicide. We've seen an increase in substance abuse. We've seen an increase in emergency room visits, and we've seen an increase in homicides and victimization of the mentally ill. So by all the metrics, this system is not working, and we have to make substantial changes.
Well,
that being the case, people are sometimes going to want to protect the status quo, but it needs to change.
Well, fair enough, and I think all of our guests on would agree with you. It needs to change, and I guess the question is, what's the best way to change it? As you're saying, you know, things like art therapy are not effective, or horticulture.
I didn't say art therapy. I said if you're talking about making collages for someone with schizophrenia, and then you wonder why someone becomes a victim or ends up in jail, it's not working.
Okay.
I didn't say art therapy. And the issue, too, that you're saying about forcing people into treatment, let me address that. It's very important. So you have about 60 million people in any given year who may have some level of mental illness diagnosable, from the very mild and transient, which everybody goes through, to more severe types. About 10 million people with schizophrenia or bipolar or severe depression. Of that, about 4 million people are not in treatment. And a reason for that is about 40% of people with severe mental illness do not even recognize they are ill. It's very important. It is similar to a person with Alzheimer's or dementia not understanding that they're ill, or a person with stroke. And the condition is called anosognosia. It's a very real part of the diagnosis. But when someone has tendencies towards violence and repeat offenses and in and out of jail, there's a point at which sometimes the best thing for that person is to help them get treatment. Now, some people will tell you you should never coerce or have a judge say someone needs to be in treatment. But the fact is that whether a person, in the 40 years I practice, I have never involuntarily committed someone. But you need something for that, for those people who are struggling and have a great deal of trouble and end up going down a road of potential violence or victimization. And along those lines, the issue is not whether or not they are compelled or encouraged or make a decision to get into treatment. Those groups' outcome is similar. The big difference is those who are not in treatment versus those who are in treatment. And that difference is dramatic. A person with severe mental illness who is not in treatment is 15 times more likely to engage in violence than a person who is in treatment. And that's very important. We want to help these people. We should be compassionate for them. And a tiny part of my bill, a couple pages, says that states that have laws for what's called assisted outpatient treatment, where a judge can say your level of illness is serious enough that because of violence and repeated hospitalizations, repeated time in jail, you need to stay in treatment outside of the hospital. That what we do is to help those states is provide funding for them. We don't tell states to have those laws. We don't tell states to not have those laws. But because we recognize that repeated studies have said you have reduced rehospitalizations, reduced crime, 90% plus consumer satisfaction with them, 80% reduction in jail time, 70% reduction in homelessness and hospitalization. It is very workable. And we want to encourage programs that work and use evidence-based to provide that help rather than read more statistics of people who are victims.
But just picking up what you just said, that is, though, involuntary outpatient treatment. It seems to me you can be for something like that, but shouldn't we call it what it is?
Well, states call it a number of things. Assisted outpatient treatment is part of that. And many times judges will talk to someone and encourage them to do it. But the issue is for someone who is struggling to understand and stay with their medication, because many times such persons may start the medication, say, I'm feeling better, I don't need this anymore, and they go down that hole again into homelessness and struggles there. And what I don't understand in this is that we wait till someone deteriorates so much, and this contributes to more neurological damage, that for somehow we have this double standard, that for psychiatric illnesses, we have to wait till you commit a crime or go to jail, whereas can you imagine if we did that, if someone came into a hospital with complaining of chest pain to say, love to treat it, you probably have a heart attack, but we're not going to do anything until you go out and hurt someone or hurt yourself. That is a phenomenally bizarre standard where we want behavioral health and physical health to be on parity, but we want them separate but equal, and it doesn't make sense to me.
Do you think people with mental illness are more likely to be violent or more likely to commit crimes?
They're more likely to be victims of crimes by a wide margin, 10 or 11 times, but if you look at the statistics as a broad group, it washes out because you're dealing with 60 million folks. And when you look at some of the studies that have done this before, they compared people who stayed in treatment versus those who were not in treatment. And this is important. So knowing that people, particularly with first episode psychosis, have a higher risk for violence, suicide in many cases too, the idea is if we get them treatment early on, help to identify them early on, and get them effective evidence-based care, it makes a big difference in their long-term prognosis. Absence of that, if we keep saying, well, we can't do anything until you say you're going to harm someone or someone else, and that is the way it works, that absence getting them early treatment, it ends up with longer-term deterioration and serious problems. And I would like to see us spare people that.
Do, though, patients, and we'll be talking about this with our other guests, but do patients, mental health patients, have the right to refuse treatment? People coming in for cancer treatments can say, no, I don't want this. Do we give those same rights?
Well, you're talking about an entirely different situation. A person who has cancer or something else says, you know what, it's time. Just leave me alone now. You're talking about someone whose brain functions entirely different. If you have a grandmother who is on the streets in January, barefoot, wearing a house robe, and she says, leave me alone, I need to get to school, do you say, well, she has the right to be in the snow? No, you say this is a person who has a brain illness of Alzheimer's, and we need to reach out and help her. So you're talking about something entirely different. You're using a different standard. You need to understand that a person with serious mental illness, again, we're not talking about someone who's got anxiety or other issues there, but whose cognitive processing is absolutely aberrant. It is not the same. The way they perceive things, the way they process things, encode things, decode them, short-term memory, long-term memory, there's many aberrations. On top of that, you may have hallucinations and delusions. But let me ask you this about rights, because many times people talk about the right to what you gave as examples, the right to be sick. Why aren't you arguing about the right to be well? And why aren't we talking about the rights of the children at Sandy Hook Elementary School to finish kindergarten? Why not the rights of the people at Santa Barbara to finish college, or the students at Oregon? Or why not the rights of people in a movie theater in Aurora, Colorado, to just see a movie and go home and see their families? Those are rights, too. So ultimately, what I'm advocating is the right for people with illness to get well, to have access to treatment. And we have this bizarre double standard in our country, including Medicaid rules, which emphasize more the right to be sick as opposed to the right to have access to good care.
We have just a couple more minutes before we have to say goodbye to you. One other part of your bill has to do with information sharing, providers sharing patient information with parents and with caregivers. How would that be helpful? What's the thinking behind that?
And keep in mind that the 95% of the rest of my bill has a lot in there for prevention, for care, for sound research, et cetera. Current HIPAA laws were supposed to work for the betterment of the patient to make sure that records are not released to harm them. Our bill, it will say in statute that therapy notes are not to be released. What we do acknowledge in rare cases for someone whose life continues to deteriorate, and especially for people with severe mental illness who concurrently will have other medical problems, heart disease, lung disease, cardiovascular disease, infectious diseases, diabetes, all have higher rates there. And for someone who's not taking care of themselves, they continue to deteriorate. To say that there, we should allow an exception, which we call compassionate communication, that the provider would have to make a decision that, number one, is this a responsible caregiver? And number two, have we tried all sorts of other ways to help this person understand and access their care? But if they continue to deteriorate and they have diminished capacity to even understand their problem, to give very, very limited information for compassionate communication, which would include such things as the diagnosis, the treatment plan, who's the doctor, the time and place of next appointment, and the medication. No therapy notes, no other details. So that the caring family member or spouse can say, at least tell me what I've got to do here so I can help this person get treatment. But can you imagine if the person was hallucinating and feeling that the tingling in their legs was messages coming from underground, as I had a patient with that. What they don't understand is that's a diabetic nerve pain, and they need to get treatment for that because they're deteriorating. We think in cases you should try all you can to help talk to the patient about that. But why have a federal law that says the family cannot be involved when you look at many of these cases, the families were pleading to have a way of getting help to their loved one. And many times doctors said, look, the HIPAA law is tying my hands and I can't tell you anything. So parents have to watch, and spouses and family members have to watch their loved one in this slow motion death spiral. We think compassion dictates we should help them.
And we have to end our conversation. I know there's much more to this bill. Tim Murphy, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. I just said goodbye to Tim Murphy, Republican representative from Pennsylvania's 18th District, serving his seventh term in Congress. And we were talking about his Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act, H.R. 2640, some of the most controversial features of the bill. And joining us now, staying with us for the rest of the hour, is Mark Salzer, professor and chair of the Department of Rehabilitation Sciences at Temple University and director of the Temple University Collaborative on Community Inclusion of Individuals with Psychiatric Disabilities. He's also a psychologist. He has worked in inpatient facilities. And Mark Salzer, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. And joining us by telephone is Leah Harris. She's a mental health advocate with the Campaign for Real Change in Mental Health Policy. And Leah Harris, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. Really pleasure to be here.
And Leah, I know that you are a critic of Congressman Murphy's bill, calling it the worst, most regressive possible direction for reform. What is your most, what do you see as the most egregious thing in this bill?
I think really using the tragic mass shooting, such as the one at Sandy Hook, as a pretext for reform is absolutely the wrong reasons to go about reform. We need change in the mental health system. There is no question. But he has such an emphasis on really punitive, regressive kinds of responses, really mischaracterizing people with mental health issues, the vast majority of whom are not violent. He takes this public safety approach to mental health. Well, what we really need is a compassionate public health approach that will really get people the kinds of supports that they need and prevent crisis in the community. That's really, I think the direction is extremely misguided.
And I want to pick up on all of that. Let me get you in on the conversation, Mark Salzer. What's your sort of overall reaction to this bill?
My overall reaction is first of all, to thank the congressman for bringing attention to mental health issues nationally. One of my favorite book titles in the mental health community is a title about the mental health system being better but not well. And I think we would all agree with that. There are lots of things that we can do to improve the system. I do think we do have one of the best mental health systems in the world.
Which may be a surprise to some people.
That's not saying much in some cases. I'd also say that the bill does have many features that are very positive, and there are good advances. But I'd also agree that the focus on criminal behavior, on mass killings, and driving certain regressive, and I would agree with that, aspects of the bill are problematic. So there's a lot of good here, but there's some things that, from a data perspective, from a research perspective, don't seem to make a lot of sense to me.
Well, let me pick up on one features of the bill. Leigh and I talked with the congressman about this in some detail. It has several names in the bill. It's called assisted outpatient treatment. It's also called involuntary outpatient treatment. He was describing it as being used for people who are really in some kind of mental health crisis as a kind of last resort. What's your response to that? This is to you, Leah.
Yes, this is absolutely not a violence prevention program. And we've often seen that it is used against people who are not violent, people of color, people who are living in poverty, who cannot get access to the kinds of services and supports that they need. And absolutely two randomized control studies have shown that it's not the force or bringing someone before a judge that actually helps people. It's actually providing the kinds of comprehensive services that they haven't gotten prior to this that actually prevent crisis. So why don't we just provide these things in the first place and make them accessible so that people don't have to kind of wait until they're in a crisis to then receive an AOT kind of intervention. That, again, in practice is used overwhelmingly against nonviolent people, people of color, people living in poverty. I think we should really be providing these services voluntarily and doing outreach and engagement, reaching out to people who are vulnerable. Here in Washington, D.C., Pathways to Housing says the thing that we need most, to provide housing and support services to people on the streets is outreach, and there's not enough people to do this. Why are we not focusing on these kinds of interventions? And secondly, There are millions of people who cannot access the kinds of preventative services that Representative Murphy is talking about, the early intervention and all of that, because their states have not expanded Medicaid. He has consistently voted against Medicaid expansion, which actually get people access to the kinds of comprehensive services and support that they really need. So I think AOT is kind of a red herring in this entire thing.
And Mark, you and I were talking about talking together before going on the air. How much of what we're really talking about is about poverty?
Well, a lot of this is about poverty. I guess I should first of all say a lot of it from a lot of the supporters of the bill, it's about crime and it's about violent crime. And the research out there suggests that people with serious mental illnesses are no more violent than the general population. There are exceptions to that. The congressman mentioned one of those exceptions. But in general, violence is not an issue of people with serious mental illnesses. So that's the thing that seems to be driving this bill or that's being used to drive the passing of this bill. Poverty is a big issue in the lives of people with serious mental illnesses. Most people are receiving Medicaid reimbursed services. We're doing a national survey right now where we're talking to people with serious mental illnesses. We're shocked at how many people are receiving Medicaid. that means they're poor people. They're not. They don't have an income to be able to afford health care. And poverty drives a number of social problems for people. Poverty affects substance use. Poverty is related to criminal behavior that might lead to incarceration. Poverty is associated with early death. Poverty is associated with a lot of things. And that is an issue that's not being addressed right now in mental health policies.
Let me go back to when I was reading a little bit about your own experience. It sounded like your mother had some mental illness in and out of state hospitals. Your father, as I understood it, was bipolar. You spent some time in some treatment facilities. And I apologize in advance for having you sort of summarize your experience. But, you know, you bring something to the table that many people don't have. How much do you think your own experience with the mental health system has made you a critic?
Thank you. And yes, you know, they say the personal is the political, and that's absolutely the case for me. My mother was diagnosed with schizophrenia at the age of 18. She received all the kinds of interventions that are promoted in this bill. She died at the age of 46. Her life was a revolving door of inpatient hospitalization, forced outpatient commitment. This was in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She ended up in jail sometimes. She experienced all of this as punitive, invasive, coercive. She was subjected to restraint and seclusion in the state hospital. She was a person on Medicaid, living in substandard housing. She was over-medicated, no supported employment, no peer support, none of the innovative interventions that have been shown to help people. You know, she didn't receive any of that. And I wish I could say her story is just an isolated incident, an isolated tragedy, but it's not. I've been an advocate for 15 years. I've talked to people. I've talked to families. I've talked to people living with addictions and mental health issues. This kind of thing is much more the norm. If you get good care, on public services, you're very, very lucky to have found, a pocket of excellence. Mm. But pockets of excellence are absolutely not enough. And our system is really failing people. The community system is under-resourced. In my own experience, as a youth, I was warehoused in all kinds of psychiatric hospitals, residential treatment facilities. When I was 18, I was dropped off in a disgusting, squalid group home, and I was told I needed to remain there for the rest of my life. And again, I wish my experience was just a terrible exception, but frankly, I hear these kinds of stories all the time from young people. And I'm very lucky that I'm even here today on this show. I mean, if my family had not agreed to get me out of that group home, support me finishing high school, support me in choosing the treatments and options that I wanted, I might still be stuck in that group home. And again, my experience is not obsolete. These kinds of things still go on today. And I think it's really important. Representative Murphy does not want to hear from the perspectives of people like me or people like my mother, who unfortunately is deceased and cannot tell her own story, who actually have been through these systems, who have great ideas, for how we can make things better. He doesn't want to hear from us, and I myself was diagnosed with serious mental illness. I got 5 different diagnoses, and I'm living this fulfilling, productive life, not because of the system, but in spite of it.
I mean, Mark, based on what Leah just said there, does good care exist? Are there programs that work, and do we have enough of them? I mean, I hear from all three of you that there are shortages, and perhaps shortages of people who can deliver the care that's needed.
I would agree. I mean, I agree with what Leah has to say, and I agree with the congressman. There really aren't enough of these pockets of excellence, it's a major issue. I mean, I get people asking me all the time, where should I go for really good services? And we do have agencies, especially in the Philadelphia area and in the region, that provide good care. But we really need funding for the kinds of services that Leah was talking about, more funding for peer specialist services, for vocational or employment services, educational services, leisure recreational services, things to help support people to live in the community again. And this actually reminds me of one of the things that the congressman was talking about, and there really seems to be a heavy focus on medications as the panacea for mental health issues. And I've worked on pharmaceutical studies. I've been involved in at least 10 of them with some of the new atypical antipsychotics that were coming out in the late 1990s. And these are not panacea cures. About one-third of the people benefit significantly from them, about one-third benefit moderately, and about one-third don't benefit at all or only benefit a little. And they also have terrible side effects. People have a terrible time with them. I'm not anti-medication. It's just we're not there yet, and we need to recognize that. And forcing people to take medications, and this is hard for me because I've seen some miracle cures to a certain extent of people who have been off and gone back on them, but there are rational reasons not to take medications. I also
because of the things like side effects?
The side effects are terrible. Side effects, we've got diabetes issues, obesity issues, cardiovascular issues. We have lots of problems, heart problems associated with some of the medications. And again, there are people out there who are anti-medication. I'm not one of them, but we have to be a little more conservative in the approach. I did want to comment on some of the funding issues that the congressman was talking about.
Sure.
Some of the, you know, the yoga classes and the kinds of the list that he went through. And yeah, I mean, for those listeners that aren't really familiar with the mental health system or don't really know what's happening in the system, it might sound absurd to folks. But there is a concept out there called personal medicine. A wonderful psychologist named Pat Deegan, who has been diagnosed with schizophrenia, helped coin this term. And personal medicine are those things in people's lives that they find to promote their own wellness and recovery and well-being, and even to counteract some of the symptoms they experience. Things like yoga, things like exercise, things like going out to coffee with friends, things that actually all of us can relate to. We all have our own personal medicines. And really, as he was reading through the list, I kept thinking these are all personal medicines, that somebody is thankfully out there talking about these and providing training on how do we support people to do this, because the medications aren't it. We have to find other things while we wait for the magic cure.
Leah, about 5 minutes before we have to say goodbye to you, but let me ask you, and this is in preparation for the show today, doing a lot of reading, and to be honest with you, I read a number of really heartbreaking stories of parents who had children with severe mental illness. They worried about them. They cared about them. Sounds like they were very much loving parents who felt like the system doesn't help me and I need help for my child. I need help for myself. How do we address the concerns of these parents and their children?
Well, yeah, and my heart breaks for these parents as well. I myself am a parent. My son is young. But if he were to have mental health difficulties, I would not want to promote the kinds of services that will actually break our trust, break trust between family members, providers, and people who are living with these conditions. We really need better access. It is absolutely difficult for people to access the kinds of supports that they need, you know, parents and families. I really think the wraparound program is terrific, you know, for example, because it really supports the whole family. We could also learn a lot from what is known as the open dialogue approach, which is used with young people who are experiencing psychosis. Mm-hmm. And it involves the family very, very much in a comprehensive approach, bringing everyone together to really be partners in making sure that this person has the best possible outcomes in their lives. We definitely need things like this. Also, families could really benefit from what is known for their adult children as psychiatric advance directives. You know, this is when a person has capacity, you know, when they're doing well, they can say, these are the kinds of things I want. These are the people that I want involved in my care. These are the kinds of interventions that I know have been helpful to me in the past. And that this is a legal document that if everyone were to adhere to this and work together on this, it could really empower families. It could empower people themselves who are living with these conditions and their providers to make sure that the person's dignity is respected and that, you know, we're really keeping the therapeutic alliance intact and not undermining trust.
But what if this person refuses? And what we heard from the congresswoman is an example, someone, let's say, that has Alzheimer's, they're wandering the street, they're in their nightgown, they're barefoot, it's winter, and they refuse treatment. How do they have the right to do that, Leah? What do families do under those circumstances?
Well, again, I think, you know, it's really about outreach and engagement, you know, and I think what can really reach people who are struggling, who might be kind of having experiences that are, not understood by the rest of the world, they can really benefit by connecting with other people who've had these experiences, who can talk to them as a peer, peer support, outreach and engagement. Again, I'm not saying people should just be able to wander and suffer and be in crisis and who cares? Of course not. It's really about engagement, meeting people where they are. You know, forcing care on people just creates distrust. It breaks down relationships. And, you know, again, I think really improving outreach, engagement, peer support, meeting people where they are, and really engaging them to be active participants in their own care, because that's how they're going to stick with it in the long run. You know, we can force people into all the treatment they want, but how are they going to become motivated to really participate in their own health, not just their mental health, but their physical health?
Mark,
so I think really we're looking at things, you know, from the wrong lens. It's not about not helping people, but how can we really help them in the right way?
Go ahead, Mark. Looks like you want to say something.
Well, no, I wanted to say that I agree completely. That is absolutely the perspective that we need to take, and it's also an evidence-based perspective. We know that coercion, we know that forced treatment drives people away from the system. I know plenty of people who say they've been committed in the past. It was such a traumatizing experience that they avoid the system really like the plague, is what I say. We also need a system that draws people. We need to have the right services and supports that people are really looking for, and it's not just one type of care. We really need to look at the whole continuum of services and focus on all the things that people want in their lives. And I absolutely love the point about psychiatric advance directives. That's an evidence-based practice as well, and this is really a nice alternative to changing HIPAA laws. It really does give the opportunity for a person to talk about who they want to receive information about what's going on in their lives. And it absolutely should be family members. I would encourage that. But it's their right to do that, and we really need to promote that more in our system.
Well, much more to talk about, Leah. We have to say goodbye to you. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Leah Harris, a mental health advocate with the Campaign for Real Change in Mental Health Policy, joining us on Radio Times today, talking about mental health laws, talking about things like civil rights, advanced directives, and providing the right care and treatment for people with mental illness. Mark Salzer staying with us for the rest of the hour. I see lots of people wanting to join the conversation. Professor, Chair of the Department of Rehabilitation Sciences at Temple University, Director of Temple's Collaborative on Community Inclusion and of Individuals with Psychiatric Disabilities. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Mark Salzer of Temple University about mental health care, privacy, safety, civil rights, all issues that came up. We began our conversation talking with Congressman Tim Murphy about a bill that he has introduced to address some of the problems that he sees in our mental health system. We also spoke with mental health advocate Leah Harris. She's very troubled by Congressman Murphy's bill, and I see a lot of people that want to join our conversation. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Just one quick thing here, Mark. 38,000 suicides a year in this country, something close to that. Most of them due to some form of mental illness. I was also reading that people with mental illness die maybe 20 years sooner than people without mental illness. The numbers of people who are arrested, often for petty crimes. You can see a fair number of them also suffering from mental illness. I mean, clearly there, you say it's the best system we've got in the world, but clearly there are serious problems that are not being addressed.
Yep, one of the best, but there are serious problems. Better, but not well. Suicide, major public health issue. Mortality rates are actually around 25 years. People with serious mental illnesses die about 25 years earlier. To be fair, some of the issues that are addressed in the bill include a suicide prevention technical assistance center. So there definitely is some attention being paid to that in the bill. And there's also a lot of efforts around integrated care, integrated physical and mental health care. And that's also discussed in the bill. So there are some good things in here. And those are really the critical issues that are impacting people's lives. The congressman did feel like this bill could have possibly prevented Sandy Hook or some of the other ones. I'm a little less optimistic about that. I'm also not optimistic that assisted outpatient treatment or involuntary outpatient commitment would necessarily have an impact on suicide rates either. That's why I've got concerns with that aspect of it. There are lots of other parts that are very positive, though.
And you talked about parity. And I mean, I guess it should be underscored that there is disparity when it comes to how we treat physical illnesses and how we treat mental illnesses.
He includes a report that is made to Congress every year on compliance with the Parity Act. So there are some wonderful things that are in here, but the focus, again, on involuntary outpatient commitment, the HIPAA changes in HIPAA laws, doing things related to protection and advocacy that are really critical to the civil rights of people with serious mental illnesses. These are all concerning aspects of the bill.
Let me see what Alyssa from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. Alyssa, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm calling in as a family member, and I'm actually a family member who's opposed to this bill, and I just wanted to share a little bit about my story and how important I've seen choice in treatment. When I was an undergrad, my younger sister was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and the next few years contained many, many suicide attempts to the point that we were certain my sister was going to die. Mm. And we had hospitalization after hospitalization. And when she turned 18, we were terrified because this meant that she had choice in treatment. And we thought that that meant that she would basically choose to die. But miraculously, we found the exact opposite to be true, and that once she held the reins and could make her own choices in treatment, she actually started to get well. So she's now 26 years old. She's working full time, and she's engaged to be married this April.
Oh, that's great.
And it's wonderful. But I believe that if she had continued down the forced treatment route, this would not be the case for her. If we had continued to try to make her do what we thought was right, I don't think she'd be in the place she is today. Mm-hmm. So what I've learned is that people do not get well in the hospital. They get stable there. But people get well in the community. And unfortunately, I believe that this bill invests in the wrong places within our system.
Well, Alyssa, I appreciate the call and obviously a heartwarming story about your sister. Let me get you back in on the conversation, Mark. And can we take Alyssa's story? And we sort of heard it from our other guests as well, from Leah Harris, and say that given the option, people can get better themselves and that hospitalization is always wrong, is always the worst thing, or forced treatment always wrong?
Right. So hospitalizations can be beneficial to people, especially when they're at that point when they require hospitalization. I really don't get into whether or not forced treatment is always wrong. I mean, I've seen actually the congressman mentioned the grandmother on the street who's in the cold. That grandmother would have absolutely been committed if she wouldn't come in on her own. If she's at danger to herself, she would absolutely get committed. So that's not really what we're talking about here. We're talking about people who are not at an imminent risk, and they make choices in their lives. And sometimes they're choices that we as family members or parents disagree with. And sometimes we have to sit around and keep coming back and watch things that are really painful and harmful. The tough thing for me, I'm a parent. I'm a father of three sons. Hi, Josh, Ben, and Joseph. Two of my sons have just recently entered adulthood. They make their own choices in their lives. I have family and friends who deal with substance abuse issues for their children, who, there are obesity issues. There are relationships that are harmful. There is diabetes and high blood pressure. They're not taking medications. They're not taking care of themselves. As a family member, as a parent, certainly I get it. I want to force my kids, if that were them, to do something different. But as parents, we're not able to do that. And one of my concerns here is we don't talk about these other illnesses or diseases or healthcare issues that address that affect people's lives. It's only people with serious mental illnesses that we focus on. The congressman mentioned anosognosia. Look, there is a concept out there related to neurological disorders. It's not clear to me from the research that it's really a hallmark feature of serious mental illnesses.
Which is that you don't know you're mentally ill. Is that
you don't it matters on how it's measured. Typically, it's measured by admitting to having a mental illness or admitting that you need treatment. There are lots of reasons to not admit that you have a mental illness that have nothing to do with lack of insight. There is prejudice and discrimination out there that affects people in employment, well-documented in employment, interpersonal relationships, housing, all those kinds of things. We also don't use those same standards. Speaking of double standards, we've talk about people not taking medications and forcing them if they have a serious mental illness. But we know that compliance rates with diabetes, high blood pressure, smoking, and obesity, everyone knows that this stuff is harmful for you. People are not compliant with wellness or medications or whatever, and we don't talk about them as having anosognosia. We say, fine, you're making a bad choice. You're going to die.
Choice.
It's people with serious mental illnesses that we really focus on.
Because it's a civil rights issue? Is that how we should frame it?
I think it's a prejudice and discrimination issue. I think it's why it's prejudice and discrimination towards people with serious mental illnesses is rampant. It has not decreased over the last 10, 20, 30 years. It's just as virulent as ever. And this is harming people. It also drives people away. Stories about violence, stories about mass killings, these kinds of stories that are out there are driving people away from our mental health system as well. People don't want to have that label. If you introduce yourself as somebody being diagnosed with schizophrenia, you're not going to get that job. You're not going to get that date. You're not going to have that relationship. You're not going to get that house. You're not going to be welcome in church, synagogue, or mosque oftentimes. So we have to do something about that.
Let me get Regina from Downingtown to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Regina. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I want to applaud the congressman for taking the stance that he is. I haven't heard him say anything about his approach that would be objectionable to me as a family member. My son had schizoaffective disorder. We struggled with the mental health system for 11 years. He eventually committed suicide.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
If there had been more resources, if there had been more programs to work with us effectively as a family, I am convinced that that would never have happened, that my son would have ended up throwing in the towel and jumping off of the Walt Whitman Bridge,
oh,
frankly.
Goodness. Wow.
I'm just appalled. And here's one thing I hope everyone will keep in the back of their mind. I'm sure that the congressman doesn't have 100% of everything right. But what bothers me is that when someone like him steps up to the plate and really tries to make a significant difference within the system, that does not work, by the way, then he's attacked and his methods are attacked. And rather than, and I heard one of your speakers say this, there's many good points to what he's trying to do. And I'm so disheartened that we don't come together more to really change the system for the better and save these folks and save other folks. I'll tell you this, and this is something I've only repeated to one of his doctors. When my son committed suicide and these rampant incidents of mass murders came to the surface, I said to one of my doctors, his doctor, that I was so glad that my son didn't choose to hurt others. Mm. Because he could have easily have done that in the state of mind that he was in. So I hope the congressman will keep the fight going. I hope others will join him and help to create change in this system that we much need throughout our society.
Well, Regina, I really appreciate you calling in, and I think we can all agree that there has to be some consensus. And frankly, one of the reasons that Mark Salter is here is, while he has some criticisms with the bill, as he said earlier, there are a number of features in the bill that he feels are really positive and perhaps could have helped your son, you know, we need better care. We need more care. Mark?
I agree completely. And again, my condolences to you and your family as well. Absolutely. And I think that that's what Leah was talking about, is having this dialogue, asking the congressman to bring together lots of voices to talk about this bill, and maybe being a little bit more flexible in how the bill is crafted, and maybe not trying to sell it in the way that he's doing that might cause harm to people. I mentioned Pat Deegan earlier. After the Connecticut shootings, Pat Deegan, the psychologist who was diagnosed with schizophrenia, she also put together a video that she put online talking about her reaction when that shooting happened. She knew that the media was going to target people with serious mental illnesses, and that hurt her. And I've heard other people talk about that as well. And absolutely agree. I think if we have more resources, especially those that promote recovery and wellness, supported education programs, supported housing, supported employment, socialization programs, community integration-oriented programs, that those are the kinds of things people want in their lives. And that might save lots of people from, in some cases, lives of misery in quiet desperation.
Regina, thank you so much for calling into Radio Times. Let me see what Lois from Arizona has to say. And Lois, go ahead. You're on Radio Times as well.
Hi.
Hi there.
sorry, excuse me.
Sure.
I live in a state where we have an involuntary treatment law. My daughter was on it for 8 years. And as I'm listening, and it, thank God it saved her life, and not from the perspective of suicide, but from this, the perspective of the severity of her illness. And when I listen to people who are against Tim Murphy's bill talk about why they're against it, and they talk about peer support and community, I don't even understand the words they're saying, because when my daughter got sick, it would have been like telling somebody who's in the middle of a heart attack, well, if you could just talk to somebody else who's having a heart attack, then you might be better. I mean, the stuff that I hear, there's something wrong with her brain. And when she had her first psychotic break, if we weren't able to get her, we didn't even know what was happening at the time, but if we weren't able to get her to medical care, get the involuntary treatment that forced her to take the medication, I can guarantee you she wouldn't be here today, just simply from, you know, being a young woman. She was 19 years old, you know, wandering the streets psychotic and not, you know, thinking thoughts that just were nowhere near attached to reality. So I don't know what any of
the, I hear you.
I listen to the people talking, and I don't understand at all, how does somebody even access all these wonderful community services they're talking about when they're so psychotic you can't have a conversation with them? And consequently, because of that feeling, now that my daughter does have insight, and there is such a thing as lack of insight, by the way, she had it. I am friends, we're a small group of people, thank God, but I know many people whose kids have no insight. It's when you're psychotic and you are thinking that you're Jesus. You don't think you're Jesus, you know you're Jesus. And no one can talk you out of it. You don't have any insight. You don't know who you are. You don't know that the thoughts that you think that you're thinking are not real.
You know what, Lois? I hate to do this to you, only because we have about a minute before we have to end this hour of the show. I appreciate you calling in. I think you raised some really good points, and I want to give our guest Mark Sulzer a chance to weigh in. Go ahead, Mark.
Yep. I mean, I think the point is that there are lots of states. The majority of states already have involuntary outpatient commitment laws, and they do work for some people. I've definitely heard those stories, and I think that that's wonderful. And I absolutely agree that at certain points in people's lives when they're so psychotic, and I would say that that's psychosis and delusional thinking rather than anosognosia, the technical way that it's talked about in medicine, that at certain points people won't necessarily appreciate other kinds of supports that they could be given. But once that psychosis has lifted to a certain extent, these other resources, if they were more available, and they're not, could be beneficial, hopefully, to your daughter at this point.
Are you worried at all that we would go back to the institutions of the past? And we're almost out of time here.
I'm absolutely worried about it. There was actually a JAMA article that came out by two putative experts in this area who were calling for return to asylums, at least to think about it. And these are not great places. These are not healing places. that would not be a good move.
Well, we could go on, and clearly there's a lot of interest in this topic. Mark Celso, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Yeah, my pleasure, Mark.
You're welcome. And he's professor chair of the Department of Rehabilitation Sciences at Temple University, director of Temple's Collaborative on Community Inclusion of Individuals with Psychiatric Disabilities. We began with Republican Congressman Tim Murphy of Pennsylvania. Also with us, Leah Harris, a mental health advocate with the Campaign for Real Change in Mental Health Policy. Appreciate all those phone calls to Radio Time. Sorry we couldn't take them all. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about the program. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.